need is love. This is Love in the 21st Century, and as promised, we are talking about love and family. We are going to be talking about a topic that I think Julian and Emily and I are just not that well versed in, quite honestly, which is long-term relationships, but more specifically, decade-long marriages and blended families. So thank you so much, Susan and Steve, for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited. This is a show that's been, you know, in the making. I think when we first started, Julian, we talked about having people come on and just talk about their own experiences and relationships. Yep. Because this show is really about people relating to, you know, to us on a personal level, on a level that, like, some of you maybe had a conversation with, you know, last night, or somebody that you would likely meet. So this is perfect that we're just, you know, having this conversation with people that are living the life.
The life of love.
The life of love, indeed. So, yeah, maybe you, Steve or Susan, whichever you feels like, wanted to kind of jump in first, but give us kind of a lowdown on you guys. I mean, I know you, so would you do us the honors of giving us a little explanation of who you are and your relationship?
Sure. We met at Michigan State University back in the 1970s.
Nice.
Got married in 1978, I think. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
June 3rd. Got that right.
Ooh, wow. We just passed the anniversary.
Oh, yeah. Happy anniversary. Yeah, we did.
Nice.
We did. And, yeah, we were in Michigan until about 1990. Susan taught at Central Michigan University in the English department. I taught at MSU in the English department. Similar fields, as we'll explain at some point. And we moved to the University of Nevada, Reno in 1990, got kind of dual positions in the English department at UNR. Susan taught, directed the first-year writing program for a long time, and I developed a graduate program in writing. That was a good move for us because Susan had been commuting the 70 miles to central Michigan when we were in Michigan, long haul, 3 days a week, 4 days a week. Nevada proved to be great for us. And we moved over to California in 2007 upon retirement, bought some land, and have opened a family farm with two of our kids and their significant others.
The beginning of our relationship really was a professional relationship. So it was based on kind of mutual interests, wanting to share the same conversations. And when we first met, he was my teacher. I was working on a PhD, and I finished a master's at Michigan State, and then somebody said, oh, you want to work with Steve Judy. And so I took some classes, and I really liked his classes and changed my field from 18th century literature to composition, English education. So our first relationship was really working together. He hired me as a contributing editor to a journal that he edited. We did some writing together. We started a newsletter together. We started working on a book before we got married and finished it after we got married. So
we were, in fact, married to other people at the time, the professional relationship.
Yes, right. We were both married to other people.
That's an interesting note.
What was the book you wrote together called?
The first one was The English Teacher's Handbook. And it's we're both progressive educators. So the book is about how to have a humane, progressive, student-centered, language-centered English class. So literature and writing and not lessons. So it was really fun because we shared that philosophy of how to reform English so that it was more attuned to students and less rigid and test-oriented. And so we were really on the same wavelength from the very beginning. And I think that's one of the things. I like friendships as a way into a romantic relationship because I think you know each other in lots of different ways before the romance begins. And I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, it reminds, you know, I guess it was a, you all know Dexter, the HBO show Dexter.
There was the one about a serial killer?
Yes, definitely. So he was about to kill this couple. You know, they were like laid out on the boards and, you know, he's about to slice them up. And he's like, they were a couple that would kill people together. And so he's asking them like, what do you guys do? Like, how does your relationship succeed? And he's having troubles with his wife or whatever, and who of course ends up getting murdered. And their answer was because we want the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds similar to what you guys are talking about in a wholly different atmosphere.
Less morbid,
yeah.
Less morbid kind of way. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like you're working. We work together on the same things, towards the same things.
Right.
And so how that carries over into your relationships and your marriage and your life and blending families, I mean, was that in alignment in that realm as well around that time?
Yes, I would say. I think we were totally agreed on what we wanted by way of family before we got married.
And so just a quick overview, you each had one child before in the previous marriage.
Right.
That was about around the age of 10 when you entered into your marriage together. And by the time you entered into your marriage together, you guys both had full custody, so you ended up blending these families.
Right.
Okay. And you had two kids of your own.
Yeah, I would say the hardest part of our marriage, and this is kind of a tender area, as our therapist would say, I think it's the hardest thing that we did. And in a lot of ways, I look back on that time, and I'm sort of surprised that we made it through that period of time. There was a lot of tension surrounding my kid, your kid, new baby, another new baby. And it was exacerbated by the fact that I was teaching 70 miles away from home. Steve was great at taking care of the kids while I was gone, but since there was a lot of tension in the household, I think for me, leaving was difficult. I'd spend the night when after all my babies were weaned, all two of them. There would be tension leaving, and there would be tension coming home and re-entering. And so I think those were really hard years for us, the hardest years.
Harder for Susan than for me, I think. I think I was oblivious to some aspects of how difficult it was for her to manage what she was doing. She just put her head on the table.
Yeah, it sounds like there's
I think that's an accurate assessment. She may say differently, but I took care of the kids. People were coming to understand fatherhood more thoroughly as a partnership in the early 70s, late 70s, and I bought into that with enthusiasm, but still at this point, don't think I did as much. Well, I know I didn't do as much as Susan did, so the hardship was more on her side than mine, I think.
And we had one angry child, one child who was really hurt by his parents' divorce, and so dealing with his anger was really hard for me. I was intimidated by that role. I think I wanted to be a good parent to him, but I ended up not being a good parent, and so that's a really painful thing. I think Steve is really supportive of my parenting, but I think there's a lot of stuff about step parenting and blended families that show the difficulty of managing that it's really hard for those marriages, and often they fail. And I think it was just that we said at the very beginning, we are not going to get a divorce. Mm-hmm. And we are not going to have our children go through this again or to go through this again ourselves. I was in therapy for a while trying to cope with how to manage the tension in the household. And I think those were just really difficult years. The first, I would say, 5 years of our marriage, I think but also wonderful because we're in the romantic phase. We were doing a lot of writing together. We wrote 3 or 4 more books during those first 6 or 7 years we were married. And so there were a lot of really fun things that kept us going, but there were a lot of hard things during those years.
But you're quite right. We were absolutely committed to no divorce second time around.
I would imagine that's what makes a big difference in most relationships is that commitment. And, you know, the first 5 years, I would say, are challenging for anybody. I mean, like, mm-hmm. really, like, the statistics that I've looked at, the divorce rate happens in those first 5 years for first-time mm-hmm. marriages, you know, most commonly in the first 3 years. So, kudos. 37 years, yeah.
Over that time, I'm curious, you've alluded to some, but what's the breadth of the projects you've done together? Other than books, you know, like what other things have you worked on together? What's the scope of that?
Well, professionally, we were both members of the same professional organizations, did a lot of speech-making, workshop giving. One part of our projects, we kind of branched out into young adult nonfiction about 5 or 6 years into our marriage. We'd been writing strictly professional stuff for teachers. Here's how to organize your teacher. We did a project for the East Lansing, Michigan Arts Workshop, which was an after-school class called Gifts of Writing. And the idea was that kids too seldom get an audience for their writing. So we said, treat your writing as a gift. And we had them do things. They made stationery. They made books for grandmother. And one thing led to another. We sent in a book proposal to Scribner's, and they accepted it. So that was, I think, our second book together.
And then we did another one called Putting on a Play. But this is really interesting because it shows how differently we approach the relationship.
Yes.
When I get on, I want to talk about the relationship. I want to talk about our relationships with the children, our relationship with each other, our tensions, our fights, our interests. And he wants to talk about the professional things that people do, and I want to talk about the relationship.
It's a guy-gal thing, don't you think?
That's what's happening over here. I mean, Julian's the one who asked the question. Yeah.
I was noticing the difference as well.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to look at that. I mean, it's maybe what, you know, creates connection for, I know Julian's mentioned before, when you guys did the love languages test, the two of you, Tammy, quizzed Julian on the five love languages, and you said...
On the air, yes.
Yeah, on the air, like last year or something, and, yes. And Julian...
It's a sacrificial lamb.
You mentioned your love language was project oriented, right?
Yeah, I had thought going into it, my love language would be, I would receive affection, that would be the most important thing for me. Just knowing myself.
It's service, though. I think the term is actually service.
Service.
Yeah, I don't think project is on the.
Yeah, I didn't think so either. So I was curious about that.
But whatever.
I could see that's why
you call project oriented if you want to.
Yeah.
Steve is very project oriented, and so even sometimes in our relationship, he'll work on things as a project. You know, he'll say, what is it we need to do to be happy together?
And it'll give me some instructions.
Yeah,
you know, I can follow
smart.
Rules. I can turn it into a project. I can get it
done. Yeah, I like that.
I think that's a common theme I've heard in relationships as well, in my own relationships, that like a very like, just tell me what I need to do and I'll do it. And it's like, it's not always that simple, I think, for women. It's like like a much more involved process, and it's not like just follow the 1, 2, 3 directions, and it's like every time that's going to work.
Sometimes. I've actually encountered a lot of women who are like, seriously, if only XYZ was done, we'd be fine. And I tell him to do XYZ, and he says, okay, and then he doesn't do XYZ, and then, you know, so then there's that resistance there to actually changing or growing or whatever. So I don't know. I feel like it could go either way.
Absolutely.
Have you two experienced what happens when one of you is growing in a certain direction and the other one is feeling the need for connection with each other during that growth? Like maybe it's not the same direction. I don't know if I could rephrase that if that didn't make very much sense.
I don't think that most of our issues in our marriage have been about growing apart, because I think that pretty much because when we moved to Nevada, we worked on, even though he's the one who developed the graduate program, we worked on the graduate program together. We had students together. We would both be on PhD students' MA committee or PhD committee. So we were constantly, we taught a couple of classes together at the university. So we were mostly, you know, forever kind of working on projects together. So I'm not sure that there's anything that took us in different directions. But I, until recently, I've needed connection much more than Steve has. I think that's true.
She just dropped the ball over in my court. As you phrase it, I suppose that's true. I think the needs for connection probably differ.
Is it like an introversion, extroversion difference?
Might be. That's more my style, the introversion. Susan is nothing if not an extrovert.
We got a lot of facial expressions going on over here.
Right. Okay.
If only they could see.
Yeah. I'm shy.
Well, women feel a sense of, you know, community and connection through togetherness often, and that's, I know, a sweeping generalization, but sometimes those are effective. And when it comes to, you know, primary difference between men and women, there is, you know, if you look back, right, a hunter-gatherer, he's out there, you know, doing the thing on his own solo, and the woman is back with, you know, the other mothers and children and stuff, and so that makes sense.
That does make sense. I think because you look back, I'm 71, Steve is 73. You look back over your life and you think, you can't help but think, what might I have done differently? And for the children's sake, I sometimes think that I probably should have, no, I don't think I probably should have. I think about what life would have been like if I'd stayed home with the children. Steve said early on in our marriage, I had two teenagers and a toddler and an infant, and he said, "You know, you don't have to work." And I did take a semester off when Mojo was born, and a year off when Cheetah was born. But it also seemed important to me to be a model for them of a woman a mother who was also competent in the world. And it seemed especially important for my daughter, who ironically has become a stay-at-home mom with her with her children.
I want to go back to the connection question. What was the connection that you were looking for, that I was looking for less than you were?
Well, I mean, I think that I've always wanted more physical closeness than you have, more hand-holding, more
PDA.
More touch my hair when you pass my chair. Little things mean a lot. Do you guys know that song? It's very old.
Sounds like a good one.
Notes.
Yes. Little things mean a lot. We should play that. And I guess I thought that he was more interested in his professional life than his family life. And that's not to say that he didn't really help with the children, because he did. When I was on Tuesday nights, every Tuesday night, he took all four of them swimming. And if I had, I was, I mean, we were both also kind of on this track of making it in the profession. So he was president of a national organization. I was president of a state organization. He was doing a national journal. And so I think that I cared about my professional life a lot. I was ambitious, but I think he saw it more central to him than I did, and I saw my connection to him as more central to my life. And I can't come up with any good examples.
As a 70s guy, I actually was aware of that as an issue and tried to work at it, make it a project, that is, to make certain she felt totally free to pursue her profession. But I suspect my idea of pursuit there was more oriented to my own perspective on what one did or what one didn't do. But I do recall vividly in the 70s trying to say, okay, I don't assume that the woman's place is in the home exclusively. I think job equality is important. And so I'm...
But what I'm saying is I wanted love more than I wanted that.
Yeah.
I mean, the support was great, and it showed his love. It did.
Absolutely. You know, guys do things... They save up for big things. And then they'll be like, look at this big thing. Like, I worked 2 months evenings so I could buy you this nice new car. And in 2 months' time, she's already, you know, filing divorce papers because she hasn't seen her husband for 2 months. And it's like you said, the touch of my hair thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's keeping consistent small gestures throughout. It's kind of, you know, like a bit of attention builds. And every time there's a little bit of affection shown or a little bit of a gesture, some of that tension is released, you know. And it's just, you know, connection. But, you know, sometimes you can get really focused as a man on doing a big project so you can do a thing, so you can satisfy the person you care about in your life.
We've been listening to the audiobook of Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. And
I know.
Yep, it's happening.
We were on a road trip for 3 weeks. We had to put something on the radio.
And the guy uses a point system in it. John Gray creates a little point system, and he says that men see those big gifts as lots of points, and then, you know, that's and that should suffice for a while. And women see everything as one point, and so kind of doesn't matter if you bring her flowers or buy her a car, it's going to be one point. And so that's why it's better to do these consistent little gestures of love throughout the day, throughout the weeks, versus like disappear for a couple of months and come back with a one point object, right?
I think it does go back to how people express the way that they love as well, because I mean, I've read Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and again, those are always, as anything, sweeping generalizations that don't always apply to everyone, and neither do the love languages, but I just, you know, put it on the screen here, and words of affirmation, acts of service, receiving gifts, quality time, and physical touch. And people are just different in the way that they receive love and how they give love. Mm-hmm. And so what's really awesome about this quiz that we quiz Julian on, and anybody's actually welcome, there's a book and a free online quiz you can take. Just type in love languages, five love languages, and you can find out what your partner or what you personally receive and give love, so that you're actually receiving love the way you want to. So you're not like, why don't they ever, you know, spend time with me? I'm a big time person. For me, like, you can buy me all the things in the world and it wouldn't matter. Like, mm-hmm. it would be like, awesome. What, you don't think I can buy anything for myself? Like, that's kind of the message that I get. Like, instead of, like, spending time with me. So, like, the 2 months would be like, who am I even in a relationship with? Like, I wouldn't even feel like I was
a man who's working hard to buy you a new car and you have no idea.
But the car, like Emily said, means less to me than the time spent with me. And so it's really important to find out what people are, where they're at, receiving and giving.
I think one of the things that Steve has always taken pride in is managing our finances, so that we always had resources. And, you know, of course, we were professors. We were well paid, so it wasn't like he was, you know, keeping us out of poverty. But managing things so that we could travel a lot, do things with the whole family, too, family-oriented travel.
Family time.
Yeah. And in some ways, that's the best time, you know, mm-hmm. where we're all together having fun and spending time with each other. So I think that's a way that he is, I'm saying this for you and you can reinforce this, that he's proud of how he's taking care of the family.
Yeah, it's sort of the breadwinner phenomenon, but also, I also picked up that care of family from my father, who did a really good job, and I think I picked that up from him, though there was a lot I didn't pick up from my father.
Sometimes things cause problems.
I think we should talk a little bit, speaking of giving, about Mother's Day, which has always been sort of a point of contention for, and I think it represents our different ways of giving. We don't celebrate Father's Day, although occasionally people do celebrate it against my better wishes.
They always do.
But every year I say no Father's Day. Mother's Day has always been difficult for me, and it's really important for Susan. When my own mother passed away, I kind of thought I was off the hook. And Susan made it clear to me later that Mother's Day is for the mother of your children, not just for children to feel they've got to call up mom and buy flowers and make an occasion of it. I regret, you know, Mother's Day is 300, the other 364 days. And so I resist that formal Hallmark greeting card created.
Yeah, it's a created holiday, yeah.
That's fine. You can just grab a piece of paper, grab a Crayola crayon, make a little heart, say I love you. Be like, look, it's a Hallmark day, but I'm against Hallmark. So I handcrafted this. I spent 5 minutes on it. I love you dearly. And then do something really big in a week, you know.
Right. My mom gets 2 Mother's Days, actually. Because she's Costa Rican. She makes it known to us. So we celebrate it in August, which is coming up, August 15th, and also in May. So if you're just tuning in right now, we are Love in the 21st Century. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, foothills, and beyond. And we are talking with Steve and Susan Chudy about multiple decade-long marriages and blended families. So if you have something to say, something to add, insights, questions, give us a call. It's a call-in show, 895-1114. We're going to get right back to the topic here soon, talking about maybe stages of their marriage and also some insights for people that are traveling that path.
And I have a plethora of questions in store as well.
Awesome. I'm not sure we're going to be able to cover everything for 37 years, but we're going to do our best. Okay.
As you might imagine, being poor means a life of sacrifices, frustrations, depression, and constant struggle. So what is it about Republican office holders that caused them to go out of their way to make poor people's lives even harder? GOP governors, Congress critters, and other officials perniciously insist that access to food stamps and other public assistance must be as burdensome and humiliating as possible. The latest example comes from the two Republican members of the Federal Communications Commission, which intends to expand a public subsidy called Lifeline, extending broadband internet service to all poor households. Universal access to the web is touted as essential to America's educational advancement and global competitiveness. Also, some 70% of teachers now assign homework requiring every student to do online searches. So our national interest and simple fairness say everyone should be able to connect. Yet, even though Lifeline was started in 1985 by the Republican saint Ronald Reagan, the two FCC Republicans voted no on extending this sensible idea. Luckily, they were outvoted, but they then demanded a requirement that poor families must publicly reveal that they are poor. The two Scrooges are subjecting these families to a daunting and humiliating bureaucratic process, which will prevent many kids from getting the internet access that everyone needs for education success. This is Jim Hightower saying, come on, the quote subsidy they're wailing about is a mere $9.25 a month. Compare that to the billions of dollars of fraud in the Pentagon budget, which Republicans approve without questioning. What is this sour, dark smudge on the souls of GOP officials that leads them to demean poor people, preventing them and our society from reaching our fullest potential? It's stupid, but it's also shameful.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This is Love in the 21st Century. We are talking with Steve and Susan Chudy, local programmers, about decade-long marriages and blended families. If you're just tuning in, we are a call-in show. Give us a call, 895-1114. I know, Miss Emily, you are ready to jump on a question, so yes. we can just go ahead and start there.
Okay, awesome. First of all, it'd definitely be a shame to have you two in here, 71 and 73, married for 37 years, without just straight up asking what, like, advice or tips can you give people who want to stay in a long-term relationship? I know that's a big question.
He told me not to talk too much, and then he just looks at me when you ask a question. Okay. I'll tell you the thing that's happened over the years that's been really helpful to us, and we should have done it in previous times, but is seeking therapy when you need it. When we were about to retire, one of the things what we were working on is expectations for our retirement. What did we want our lives to look like? What did we want our lives to be? So we went to talk to a therapist, and also, Steve had a lot of, even though he was at the top of his game throughout his career, he was frustrated about things that didn't happen in his career, and so there was some unhappiness about that. And so talking to her, I think, helped us go in the right direction. And he thought that his problems would be resolved when he retired, but he has such high expectations, and he's such an idealist that he's often disappointed. And so I said, you need to talk to somebody about this. So he started going to a therapist, and then they dragged me into it, and it's the best thing we've ever done. So I'm telling you now that at 37 years of marriage, we are closer and happier than we have ever been. And I think it's because we have gotten to our basic caring of each other and loving each other, and I almost want to say need for each other, except both of us resist the word need, kind of with our heels dug in the ground. No, I don't need you. I'm fine. But what we've learned is how to care about what's happening to each other emotionally, as well as what's going on in the world, and how our responses to the things that are going on in the world can either soothe us or make us more anxious. So that's made a huge difference in the past 2 years.
How your individual responses, or how your responses as a couple together?
As a couple.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I think we've learned through that to be more supportive, more candid. I think a lot of times when we were having issues, we would mask them under, well, overt anger, passive-aggressive behavior, what else? But we've learned to be more open about that and not to hide them or disguise what's going on wrong, and being able to talk about it. And then to be a good deal more supportive to each other in response to those?
Over the decades, how, if at all, have you improved at disagreeing?
Stony silence. I think now we are able to disagree a lot more directly than we used to be. We raise that, and as I said, don't mask it. I think we've always been pretty good at overt conflicts, not about the relationship as much as about the family, about work, about projects, about where we are at a given point. So I feel we've been pretty good at that.
So the relationship has been not necessarily a focus of attention in the relationship.
It would seem that naturally would have to. You guys would have to have a lot of things in common and a lot of values that are the same. Because yeah. I mean, even if you are disagreeing, you know, if you're disagreeing on, you know, really fundamental things on a regular mm-hmm. basis, your relationship's not going to last very long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have those things. You know, I guess like the disagreements for me, what comes to mind when Julian says that are just like the simple, like, I disagree with the way that you're responding to that, or I disagree with, you know, your choice in that action. Like, I don't disagree with you as a person, but I disagree just like, you know, with that action or behavior. So it seems like have those things become easier to kind of,
yeah, like when
overlook?
You're trying to cohabitate with someone,
right.
You know, you're just different people, right? And so mm-hmm. and
like
so
the toilet
inevitably
seat question, you know, that kind of stuff. We, you know, like that kind
I'm
of stuff.
I'm sorry if it feels like we're looking at you guys like something from another land or galaxy that have somehow
tell
managed to make
operate.
It. Like, so what do you do on your planet, and how do relationships happen? Fascinating.
Well, I'll just put the kind of questions that Tammy was just phrasing are the mm-hmm. kinds of questions that I don't ask.
Yeah.
I have very great difficulty being really direct and say I disagree with the way you phrase that. My style
mine,
is to withdraw
with
from that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And so, yeah, one of the bad things that would happen is that in conflict, when we would have conflict about something and it's getting less and less and less, we would both withdraw. And so there'd be this alienation and there'd be this cool period for a long time, sometimes, depending on how big the disagreement was, with not really discussion about it. And then gradually we'd kind of start talking to each other about this and that, and then we'd be friends again. And we are good friends because we do love doing the same things. We share the same values. We have really interesting, picky discussions about things like existentialism and postmodernism and philosophical, you know, nitpicky things. We basically, I think, see the world in the same way, but we somehow we get into those. But we have differences of opinion about who thinks what is clean and tidy, and so those can cause blow-ups.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things have caused alienation. And so we're trying to talk about the source, first of all, of those biases that we have about how things should be kept. And but like on money issues, we don't have basic disagreements. Our relationship is so, I don't know, lucky in that way. Because if you have things that go deeper, trying to work through those and resolve them, I think, is super difficult. But nonetheless, you know, we still have had big times of alienation over things. And so we're learning how, first of all, to lessen that, to see the sources of that, and to not get angry and push each other away under those circumstances. And, you know, I mean, after 37 years, don't you think it would kind of be something that you would sort of learn on your own? No, we didn't.
That's actually...
We needed help.
So that kind of leads into the next couple questions. First of all, real briefly, how many years have you been in therapy?
2 years in the current round, and another year and a half when we were just leaving Reno.
Yeah.
So that would be 10,
that's,
12
yeah,
years
ago. Yeah, it's a pretty small percentage of the total time together.
Yeah, but we've both been in therapy separately on several occasions.
Okay. So. And you know, like you just said, one would think it might get easier eventually, right, mm-hmm. after so many years together.
Has there been an ebb and flow? Was that the case in a way? Like after the first maybe 4 or 5 years of marriage, was there ease or was there more tension? Or, you know, when you think about overall maybe easier portions of
stages.
The relationships. Yes.
Like stages yes. throughout your marriage.
Yes. Was there more difficult stages and easier stages? And where would you say you are now?
Susan's nodding yes. You alluded to that question earlier in the program, and I've been mulling it ever since. And I can't identify stages myself. I think Susan probably can.
Waves.
or cycles or something.
Well, I think one of the things that eased the pressure on our relationship is when his and her children grew up and left the house. And mind you, I would never want them to think that, thank God, we're through with you and our life has gotten so much better. But it just got easier. You know, I'm really close to my daughter. Steve is really close to his son and to my daughter and to our grandchildren. And it's one of the things, actually, I feel guilty about. I think our older kids just a little bit got lost in the shuffle of too much work and babies in the
new
house.
Babies.
Yeah, little kids in the house. And our, you know, the family of the four of us, the four of us now live together plus our daughter-in-law. And we have pretty good relationships. We admire both of our children. I think our children admire us and our daughter-in-law. We admire our daughter-in-law. There's a lot of good feeling. But I find that really difficult, too. So, you know, when they were away at college, it was just the two of us, and now we're all back together again. And so a lot of, I think, the stages in our relationship has to do with the complexity of the other relationships in our lives. I also was a member of a women's group for about 15 years when we were living in Michigan, and my life was easier when I was in that women's group because if I were frustrated about home life, I could take it there, and I had people who, it was like therapy, people I trusted.
I think the tales that were told at women's group.
It's just support.
I have a kind of a two-parter question here. And the first part has a silent answer. And the second part has not a loud one. So if I were to ask you to think about the biggest conflict or incident in your entire 37 years of marriage, the one occasion where it was the biggest conflict that you went through in your entire marriage, would you be thinking of the same thing?
That's a really interesting question.
You're a good question, Alex.
That's a really good question.
And I got a follow-up question to that.
We could speculate about that. I have had anger management issues. They're mostly at home. They're not in public. I carefully cultivate the public image. And my bursts of anger intimidate Susan, cause her to withdraw, remind her of her father. When she does imitations of me, sometimes she sounds just like her imitations of her father. And I would guess probably the closest she's ever come to packing her bags was over my anger.
Wow.
I see Susan's nodding. Was it the same conflict?
Well, he didn't talk about a specific conflict. It was very difficult transitioning from a suburban life to farm life, and we lived on the land for the first 3 months that up in Yankee Hill that we moved there. And Steve was, and we talked about this for a long time. We had family meetings. What do we want to do? We'll invest in this if everyone wants to be involved. Everybody contributed. Mind you, the vision is really different from what's happened, but Steve was in it all the way.
Yeah, I think we had different concepts of what we had all bought into. The two sons and their partners or girlfriends at that point were more interested in farming than I am. I'm not a farmer at heart. I saw my role in the farm as helping to figure out the finances so we could buy the land and put a house on the land, all those guy things. And I think the rest of the family wanted more from me in terms of shovel and spade work, pitching in, getting involved in caring whether the broccoli came up.
Which you did. I mean, you've done a lot of work to help the infrastructure and the garden, but you were so angry. The first 3 years we were on the farm, you were so angry. You even got a book on anger management and tried to work through it. I was really, it's the closest I've come to leaving.
Okay, but that wasn't solely about the farm. We had a, well, the same right. kinds of right. stress that we'd always had during that period. So it wasn't exclusively about the farm.
But no. But the bottom line is that you guys, that you both, your minds both went to the same
yes.
timeline.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then so what was the second part?
So the follow-up question is, do you feel like that large conflict or the biggest conflict you've had to go through, it has brought the two of you closer together?
I would say at this point, yes. There's still, well, there's still over the farm. That's.
Are you still living at the farm?
I'm sorry? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's why they're here right now.
Yeah. Right. But the division of interests, I'm still not a farmer. We talk a lot about it on our radio show, but I just don't know as much about it as they do, don't care about it as much as they do.
But you're not angry?
No.
About it?
No. No, I think Susan sometimes misinterprets my anger during those first 3 years as somehow rejecting the or going back on our pledge to work together on the farm.
If that were the case,
I don't think it's accurate.
I'm trying to get in. I'm not attributing a cause to that anger. I'm just saying you were so angry and I didn't know how to deal with your angry and I wanted the hell out.
Okay, so that brings me to my next question. 37 years ago, you said, we're doing this and we're not getting a divorce. How the heck can you, at one point in your life, say something with such commitment, you know, for lack of a better word? How can you say something with such vigor like this is just, it doesn't matter what happens 30 years from now. I'm going to be in it. Period. Done.
Partic-